Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. One of my favorite writers working today is Drew McGarry, a columnist for Deadspin and Gawker, and a GQ correspondent. In McGarry's style, I often joke, in all caps of course, that he's the Twain of our times. In the age of tweets, McGarry thrives on long-form prose that's nakedly honest and blisteringly funny. In celebrating a sort of macho young white male privilege, McGarry gently undercuts it by exposing its contradictions, even as he spends 1,000 words ranking breakfast cereals. So it was no surprise when McGarry's first novel, The Postmortal, deftly explored mortality and morality. In a different way, he's returned to those very themes now. About a year ago, McGarry emerged from a few weeks of light online output to bare his soul in a column called Pain is a Gift and Other Notes from a Terrified Father During a 7-Week Premature Birth. It was a new era for a writer once dismissed as a frat boy blogger who threatened the entire sports writing establishment. The story of McGarry's third child's harrowing birth frames his new book, Someone Could Get Hurt, a memoir of 21st century parenthood, published by Gotham Books. And it's a pleasure to welcome Drew McGarry back to the roundtable. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, you're so nice. I should. Everything I say now is just going to ruin all the nice things. I should just ditch now.
See, I always figure that you weren't actually as mean or as angry as people portrayed you as being. That it was kind of a joke. Am I right about that?
Yeah, I mean, yes, definitely. I'm not like a shouty guy, like, except when the kids act. But like in general, you know, the thing that's so fun about ranting and raving online is that you get out of your system and you go about the process of being a normal person throughout the rest of your life. You're civilized and you're happy because you were such a bastard in cyberspace.
I always kind of saw your online column, which I never miss, as being like a weekly release of the id, and then you kind of get back to normal.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. I think the other thing that, you know, has been fun is that, like, a lot of guys write in, and, you know, I think, you know, the bro culture is that guys always have to be, you know, about getting drunk and getting laid, crushing some girls and all that. And underneath, I think we all have this very similar insecurities about, you know, using a toilet in public, and we all have the same sort of active imaginations about aliens and zombies, and, you know, there's all sorts of stuff going on in our head that we don't really talk about outside of writing to complete strangers online, and that to me is a lot truer than just talking about, you know, how awesome, you know, Scarlett Johansson's breasts are or whatever.
Right. For the people who write in, it's sort of everyone's in on the joke in a way.
And
that's what I love. My favorite column you do every year is the Hater's Guide to the NCAA Tournament Field. And this year, my school was in Albany, which you described as now you know you're 1/10 the way across New York State, which I loved.
And it's still like 8 hours to Albany, too. So you don't realize the massiveness of New York State until you're traversing across it.
I wondered, as you finished this, did you think of yourself as a parent any differently? Did you give yourself any different grades once you had examined the 7 years you've spent as a father or so?
No, I don't think so. I think I had a pretty clear idea of how I had progressed sort of in that time. I don't think writing it was sort of me, you know, looking back and sort of discovering things about myself. Because then the memoir itself would have sucked. Right? Because if it's, you know, if it's me going through the process of self-discovery, that's just such typical memoir awfulness, right? Right? Every memoir where it's like, it's a voyage of self-reflection, and you want to go throw it in a burning tire fire. I think that just in general, I tend to be pretty aware of why I'm doing what I'm doing, even when I'm doing the wrong thing. And that's what I usually end up writing. And, you know, in terms of being a parent, I think that I've gotten better. I know I've gotten better because I don't yell as much, and I don't spank my kids anymore or anything like that. So I think I'm learning, just like any parent has to learn. You have to learn, you know, sort of how to manage these unruly little people. And, you know, nobody tells you how to do it. You have to sort of go out and find the advice and the information yourself.
Reading this book, I felt like people will be able to justify their own attitudes toward children, whatever they may be, reflected
sure.
in your book. I don't have any. I'm a little bit younger than you, but I don't think I could do what you're doing in this book. I don't think I could spend a week bombing the house for head lice and, you know, talking a kid down from the Funland ride or something. I don't think I have it in me.
Well, that's why you have. That's why you get married, so you have someone to keep the workload with. You know, and you know, it's funny because I get a lot of emails from people saying like, I don't have kids. This book is going to scare me to death, right? And I was like, you know, I'm not someone who openly says, hey, you know, don't have kids. Your life will suck. Like, I'm glad I have my kids. Like, I wouldn't want my life to be any other way. But, of course, when you tell that to people, they don't believe you. They don't believe you for a second. They just think you're saying that out of obligation, you know, just so the kids won't grow up and be, you know, and hear, like, oh, daddy hates being with you all the time. But it's true. I do like my kids, but I also recognize that it's not for everyone. But the book was written for people who have either been a parent or have been a child, and we all fit into those categories. So.
Sure. I've asked you about this before in terms of how much you want to make your private life public. How did members of your family, not your children, but your wife and your dad in particular, take this book and your exposing some of, you know, the nitty-gritty of what it's like?
Oh, they liked it. They both liked the book. I mean, they both liked me enough where, you know, they'd support me if I robbed a bank. You know, well, he's really a good guy. He just made a mistake. You know, like, I mean, I have that sort of tight bond with everyone in my family, and I'm sure there are, you know, some uncomfortable details, but they're sort of small bits of the larger whole. Within the larger whole, the whole theme is, you know, obviously there's a positive feel to the book about how I feel about my wife and my children. So I think they can see some of the embarrassing details and write them off in terms of, you know, how they fit into the bigger picture.
You publicly disclosed a DUI arrest you had a few years ago and write
yes,
about
that's
the
right.
the shame of what that experience was like and all the steps you had to take to get past it. What was it like to explore that for the first time?
Well, it was something that I knew I wanted to sort of get into. Like, you know, as it was happening, I was like, well, this sucks. I may as well write about it. But it was, you know, it was right at that time, and I was freelancing, and I didn't want to sort of endanger my employment status. And I think the farther you get away from those sorts of transgressions, the more people are willing to forgive you, particularly if you're not a repeat offender. You know, I'm not someone who's, I have legitimately not done it since, and I never would. So if there's enough distance, you know, after the fact, and you know, then I think you can write about it, and I think that the reflection is earned. I think people believe it if you're far enough away and you've already proven that it's something that's safe in the distance.
Let's go to the start and the end of the book, which is pretty harrowing for anybody to go through. Your third child was born premature and it led to this extended stay, you know, in intensive care. How much of that were your older children aware of at the time?
My oldest is 7, so she had a pretty good idea of what was going on. And I mean, the thing about kids is that when you tell them stuff like that, they naturally sort of a defense mechanism treat it like it's nothing, right? You'd be like, you know, like, hey, you know, Bob's getting surgery, and they'll be like, yeah, he's gonna bleed a lot. Yeah, he might die. It's okay. And then they'll go like write in the coloring book. And underneath it, there's all these sort of crazy sort of things going on in their brain as they process it. But their first sort of line of defense is sort of macho posturing. And so I think my kids, you know, they were sort of blasé about it in a certain way. But then when the baby came home, they were very doting and very caring. And I think that they had an appreciation of, oh, I just realized I spoiled the book. Don't tell anybody the end of the book.
He makes it.
But
he makes it.
I think
it.
They did have more of an appreciation of the process.
And what about for you? I mean, you're very honest about what you went through. You're bawling in intensive care for weeks. I have to imagine that changed your perspective in some way.
It changed me a little bit. Like, I'm a lot more, like, I was raised in a not very religious household. And, like, you know, I sort of grew up in, like, the golden age of, you know, bad televangelism and stuff where religion seemed very, very phony to me. And, you know, I thought that for a good long time. And, you know, this process, I wasn't, you know, after this happened, I wasn't as militant about it as I used to be. I get it now. I get why people have faith. I get why faith is important to a lot of people. And I get why it's, you know, it's something, I get why it's viable, you know. I get why people want, you know, to think of some sort of higher power that keeps all the electrons spinning, you know. And I'm more curious about it than I used to be.
Not quite 100% endorsement there, but...
Well, like, I don't believe, like, for example, I don't believe that Jesus rose from the dead or anything like that. Like, I am not a Christian in that sense. But I am someone now who, you know, is willing to believe that there is something out there that I can't understand that somehow had a hand in, not, you know, doesn't have a hand in, you know, who wins a Vikings game, but, it, you know, there's some sort of force that has made, you know, this all here. But I'm still sorting that out. Give me a few more beers and a bong hit, and I'll have it sorted.
But no driving.
But no driving.
You brought up the Vikings. You're a huge football fan. I'm really interested in how childhood obsession with sports changes over time. I found as I get into my late 20s, you know, you can't live and die with every game the way you used to. How has being a father, juggling three kids, and your writing career influenced the way that you interact with sports?
Well, it hurts your interaction with sports because obviously you can't watch as many of them, right? Like when you're in college, you can watch sports just all the time because you have nothing better to do because you're single and you're a loser. And then you have kids and you have all these other commitments. You have commitments to them. You have to run errands. There's just much more of your life that is accounted for. And that gives sports sort of the short shrift. So you have to figure out what sports are important to you and what aren't. And, you know, even though there's that sense of, well, I'm older now, so, you know, I appreciate life and I can put sports more in perspective, I think, you know, I don't like it when I'm like that, right? I want to be more insane about sports. Like, I would prefer to take it far too seriously, right? So I do my best to sort of stay in that mindset when I root for my teams. And in a lot of ways, it's fun to pass it on to your kids if you watch with your kids and stuff like that, and they get into it. Then it can be a pretty rewarding thing.
The Rubicon I haven't crossed yet, and you have, is DVRing games. I can't do it. If it's not live, then I don't want to see it. I'll watch it on my app or something to keep track of it. But I imagine that, you know, it doesn't fit into the schedule anymore as much.
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, I don't mind being 10 minutes behind, right? Because then you can just skip the commercials and you can watch the game more efficiently and still have it. But I would always prefer to be live so that you can, you know, sort of be interactive on Twitter and all that stuff while you're doing it. I don't like it when, I mean, there have been times where I've had to, like, tape a 1 p.m. game and then watch it at, like, 6 p.m. And that sucks. I mean, I hate doing it. It's only out of necessity, and I would never do it if I didn't have to, ever. Like, my wife will be like, you know, she'll be like, can't you just tape it? And I'm like, no, like, you don't get it.
You wrote something recently that I related to, which was you were talking about what life would be like if you became a truck driver and you'd have unlimited access and time to listen to Howard Stern. I'm also a fan. You were recently a guest on Howard. What was that like for you after having listened to him for so long?
It was amazing. I mean, what was interesting is that, you know, I had a couple friends ask me, like, you know, were you nervous? And the thing about him is that, you know, when you get on the phone with him and you hear his voice, you know, I've heard that voice for 2 decades now. And it's such a comforting, pleasant voice. And there's no way to be nervous around it. You know what I mean? Like, that, I think, that gave me appreciation for why he, you know, is who he is. You know, he is someone who has this natural warmth in his voice and this natural just sort of manner about himself that gets people to be very open and free. And you appreciate it when you're talking to him. You realize exactly what his sort of gifts are.
You've written all kinds of stuff recently. We have this parenting memoir. You've got your weekly columns. You've done sort of, I don't want to call it like stunt journalism, but you've gone out, you were kidnapped by a group that you can hire to kidnap you.
Oh yeah, I was a stunt. I mean, if anything's a stunt, that's a stunt.
Okay,
right?
So we'll call it a stunt. And
you can call it a stunt.
You've profiled like Snoop Lion, aka Snoop Dogg. Is there a type of writing or reporting that comes easier than others? I mean, is your weekly column like you bang it out, or does that actually end up taking more time for you than, you know, going out on the road and getting kidnapped?
No, they're pretty equal. I think the only times where we have any real problem is if it's just a sea of dead news and something has to go up, there's nothing really new to, there's no stimulus. There's no outside stimulus for you to write, right? Like if you go on the road and you experience something, very easy to write because there's just you're just seeing new things. There's lots of material to work with. But if you're just at home and there's no sort of news to react off of, or no one's emailed you some sort of idea of their own that you're sort of batting around in your head, then I think it can be a bit difficult because you're just pulling, you know, you're just trying to get blood out of a stone, and there's just nothing there. And you know, I mean, I've posted bad things in that sort of situation, and everyone has. There's nothing you can really do about it. But then you just wait, and you know, eventually stuff happens again. So that's always good.
You write at home. You stay at home.
Yeah, I write at home.
Do the kids respect that space you have, or do you find yourself interrupted a lot?
They're pretty good about it. Sometimes my son will come in, and then I'd say I'm working, and then I'd kick him out. But it's not that bad. I close the door.
You hated when you worked in an office. I think you were in New York City back in the day. You've written about this before. Do you prefer staying at home with the kids, or would you, you know, rather get away sometimes?
You know, when I started working at home, I wanted to get away. And now I manage it to the point where I'm glad I do it. Like, I don't, particularly where I live in the D.C. area, and traffic here is so miserable, you'd never want to commute. So I'm all, like, it's always fun at, like, 5 o'clock, you know, sort of, like, think about all the suckers on the Beltway who are stuck, and, you know, you're free, you can do whatever you want. So I'm cool with it now. I don't have much of a problem with it. Plus, I interact with enough people online where I don't feel like I am alone. And that sounds very sad, but it's nice to have people to sort of G-chat with and chill out with during the day.
That's Drew McGarry. He's the author of Someone Could Get Hurt, a memoir of 21st century parenthood. You can also read him in Deadspin, Gawker, and GQ, and elsewhere. Drew, as I say, I'm a huge fan of yours, and it's been a real pleasure to have you back on the roundtable, and we'll have to catch up with you again sometime.
Anytime. Thanks a million, man.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.